You're listening to Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network.
So, hey, everybody, welcome back to Screen Heroes. This is episode 198. Screen Heroes is, of course, the TV and film podcast here on the Heroes Podcast Network. I am Derek, your regular host, and I have my other two lovely hosts with me, Ryan.
Hi.
And Ray.
Hi.
And we are here this week to talk to you about the live-action Sin City film on its 15th anniversary, based off of the graphic novel, of course. But before we
the many graphic novels. It's not just one graphic novel.
That's true, yes. But before we do that, we will go ahead and talk some news. First things first, let's talk AMC. What's going on in the world of movie theaters?
Okay, so from what I get, AMC has spent like the last 10 years buying up theater chains and has run their credit into the ground. And because of that, they might not be considered trustworthy enough to get a bailout from this whole thing. So they might completely go under, which is pretty horrible for Kansas City. Like, that's thousands of jobs right then and there with corporate. And we also have, what, I think 8 locations between the two states. So it's not great.
No, it's not. They're huge. You know, they're owned by the largest theater chain in the world internationally, largest in the U.S. It would certainly be bad news. I don't even know what would happen to all of those massive buildings, because I don't think there's enough other chains to buy them up.
Yeah, so to be more specific about exactly how bad it is, they were a B. It had been downgraded from a B to a CCC-, which I didn't know was a thing, which the definition of that is default imminent with little prospect of recovery.
Whew.
It says they reported a $5 billion plus deficit in 2019 and losses of $149 million for the year.
In the year that Endgame happened.
Right.
And The Rise of Skywalker.
Right.
Just want to be clear. Okay. And Joker, for that matter.
Yes. And obviously, movie theaters are pretty heavily hit this summer, or this spring, and going into the summer, probably going to continue. And yeah, it's going to devastate our area. But I mean, it's basically, I think, the biggest theater chain in the country.
Yeah, it is. They are the largest theater chain in the country, which makes it that much worse, because then you have to wonder, well, how are other companies faring? How Cinemark and Regal, for example? You know, we used to have a Phoenix Theater, but that was bought by AMC. And then there was Cinetopia, which was bought by AMC. And so I'd be curious to know how well some of these other chains are doing. Well,
we also have B&B around here. I don't know how far they go out, but,
Yeah, no, they're a national chain. You know, and Alamo Draft House is a national chain as well, but significantly smaller.
Aren't they 3 theaters or something? So.
No. They definitely have more than that, but I don't think they have more than one in any given city metro.
I thought it was just one in Texas and one here, basically.
No.
Okay.
No, they have a lot more than that, but they're certainly not 8 in a city like AMC is. It's a shame. It's bad news. It will certainly limit where you'll be able to go and the options that you have. I'm sure that the A-list thing didn't help them out as much as they had hoped. And we all saw how well MoviePass fared. So
the article does say the most realistic probability would be that its competition Regal Cinemas could purchase AMC theaters and just convert them to their own.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that would be a very large purchase, of course. But I guess
in the era where Disney buys Fox, purchases are an everyday thing.
As long as it's not Disney buying AMC, that's what I don't want to see.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be vetoed, right? Because that would be a huge monopoly over the entertainment industry, more so than they are even now.
I agree with you, but I also thought that their acquisition of 20th Century Fox would be considered a monopoly as well, and I was wrong. So I don't know what the rules are anymore.
There are no rules. So, yeah, Regal swooping in and picking them up would be the most likely situation if, for some reason, they aren't able to scramble and pull together here. But as far as businesses goes, the bank could take it over and completely sell it apart, location by location, or to completely different businesses. Some of these buildings are really in prime locations in the Kansas City area. I can imagine that's the same for the whole United States, and other businesses may want that property. Or we could see something like amphitheaters that get sponsored, you know, other companies that are in different parts of the media just take over the theaters. Like, it's, you know, Verizon's AMC was the example I gave earlier, but that's also usually just naming rights, like Derek pointed out. It's not usually ownership of the amphitheater. So all kinds of crazy stuff. But yeah, the last thing we want is studios buying up theaters.
Mm-hmm. All right, so moving on then, in streaming news, a brand new streaming service released and premiered this week, actually today as we're recording this on Tuesday. And it's called, what did you say it was? Quibi?
Quibi.
Quibi.
It's Quibi.
Quibi. So I decided to sign up for it and check it out. You can get 90 days for free, so I figured, why not? There's been lots of commercials for it. They've got a lot of high-profile actors involved in their shows. The kind of gimmick for this is that these are designed specifically for smartphones. There's an iOS app and there's an Android app. That's how you watch them. And you can watch them both in portrait mode or landscape, and they look different depending on how you view them. They actually kind of are edited slightly differently for those different viewpoints. So I checked out three different shows. And all episodes are 10 minutes or less. So they're meant to be bite-sized, kind of easily bingeable things. So I checked out three different shows. The first one that came across my list of things to choose from was Chrissy's Court, which is Chrissy Teigen playing a celebrity judge court show. Her husband showed up for a little bit in it. Their kid was in the back. It was cute, I guess. Very silly and kind of, I don't know, like, they talk about how it's real, but I it was really strange. I also checked out Will Arnett's show, which is called Memory Hole. It's kind of like a, remember those shows on TV that were like a recap of a decade?
Oh yeah, the I Love the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, I gotcha.
So it's like that, but for things that most of us have kind of forgotten about. So okay. The first episode was about football-themed raps and dances and songs, starting with like the Super Bowl Shuffle, which was the Chicago Bears. And that was the whole episode. Again, it's like 7 minutes. It was fine. Will Arnett was fine. He sings at the end, playing a character. And then the third and final show, which was actually the most promising thing that I saw on there, is The Most Dangerous Game, which stars Liam Hemsworth and Christoph Waltz. And I watched two episodes of that, actually, and that's pretty good. The production quality is fairly high. The performances have been pretty solid, and so I'll probably keep checking that out, at least while it's free.
Okay.
Do you guys have any thoughts on the new service?
I can see its value for things like bus rides and stuff like that, but honestly, I'm not quite sure it is going to last.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know what these shows cost to produce, given the casts that are involved. They're so short. An entire season is like a movie, I guess. So I'll be kind of curious to see how that shakes out. I watched my stuff over lunch today, because they're short enough to do that. I mean, I watched four total episodes, which resulted in like a half an hour of content. So thought it was relevant as a new streaming service. So
like, they're pulling good talent. So yeah. I mean,
not cheap talent either. So it makes me wonder how long they can do that.
Well, I mean, that's how you got to do it, is show that you have some big names behind this, and it's not just a couple of lucky gets.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on there that just really isn't for me, I think, is part of it. There's a lot of, like, LeBron James has a show called I Promise. It's a documentary that's out there that people may or may not be interested in, just as an example. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of sports stuff. There's a lot of, there's some animal and food content, you know, things like that. That, I mean, J-Lo's got a thing on here called Thanks a Million, human interest type thing. So there you go. But check it out, I guess, if you want. It's free for 3 months, so you got nothing to lose. All right, what else do we have? Any other news that we want to cover today?
Well, I know Derek didn't, but Ryan, did you watch Onward this weekend?
I did, yeah.
Yeah? How'd you like it?
Did you watch it?
No, I have not watched it yet.
I liked it. I mean, it was, you know, I'm not the biggest Pixar fan, but
right,
I do enjoy some of their stuff. And, I mean, it was good. It was enjoyable. It wasn't, like, top-tier Pixar for me, but certainly, okay, you know, I like Dungeons and Dragons, and it's all kind of based around one of the characters' love for a similar game in a world where it's more of a historical game than a fantasy game. So
that's cute.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys would really like it. I don't think you'll put it in the upper echelon of Pixar movies either, but yeah, I enjoyed it. And the fact that it's very recent to the theaters movie on Disney Plus, was, I'd be curious their streaming numbers on it.
Okay, cool. Good to know.
All right, well then, this is where we would take our little break here. And when we come back, we'll be talking about Sin City on its 15th anniversary.
Recently on the Heroes Podcast Network, Echo Station.
Well, what's the main planet that Endor, the forest moon of Endor? It's a moon. So there's a major planet, obviously, that it...
Is the forest moon of Endor? Is Endor the actual planet, then?
See, isn't that confusing? Yes. Is it the forest moon of the planet Endor, or is it the forest moon called Endor?
Kaiju Curry House.
Because I'm just wondering, are Pokemon kaiju?
They are pocket monsters. They are pocket monsters, Paul.
They're monsters, aren't they?
They are yokai, officially.
Yokai?
Yeah, so...
What's a yokai?
Red shirts and runabouts.
Something we've talked about before, and other people have, but there's so much of real-life history involved with Star Trek. From Gene Roddenberry's days, his time in the military as a bomber crewman, you know, James Doohan serving, all these people and all these real-life events that have impacted things. That's very realistic of political and military leaders kind of resigning in protest at a decision they can't control.
Subscribe today at heroespodcast.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, Podcast Addict, and more.
All right, welcome back. So let's do this. Let's talk Sin City. Sin City, of course, released in 2005, which is why we're celebrating 15 years. It released actually on April 1st, 2005, so earlier, about a week ago. It had a budget of $40 million. Opening weekend pulled in just over $29 million, with its total domestic gross just over $74 million, bringing its worldwide gross to over $158.5 million. Which is not super impressive, though significantly better than its sequel, A Dame to Kill For.
Do you guys remember when we watched movies in theaters?
What was that like?
I mean...
It wasn't that long ago. What was the last movie we saw? Birds of Prey?
The last one I saw.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So, Sin City. Huge cast, of course, in Sin City. And incredible cinematography. I mean, that's, I guess, as good a place as any to start. It's my favorite looking movie of all time.
Oh, wow.
Story and everything aside, just the actual way it looks is incredible. And I wish that there was more of that. It's probably why I enjoy the second one as much as I do, because I just think it's gorgeous. specifically the way color is used. You know, I'm colorblind, and so I like seeing things that use really high contrast or use color in very purposeful ways. And Sin City surely does that. Lots mm-hmm. of grayscale, black and white, with small pops of color with a specific object or a specific character, or even a part of a character, just to highlight a trait. And it's easy for me to see and enjoy. What about you guys? What are your thoughts on the visuals?
It was good. I mean, this is my first time watching it. It's worth mentioning. So, you know, it was all new to me. I thought that I did like the contrast on the occasional, you know, important object or whatever, or important person or important feature. But in some parts, the black and white got a little too busy for me. It was hard to follow what was going on. The scene with Marv in the rain would have been really cool, but like it was really hard to tell what was going on a lot of the time because the rain was so heavy. It was a cool concept for sure. I don't think that it's cool enough to carry multiple movies, which is probably why the second one didn't do very well. I haven't seen the second one, so maybe it was great and it just was missed out on. But you know, it's a cool like one-time concept, but I don't feel like I need to see a lot of movies done this way.
Yeah, two is fine. I don't think two is bad by any stretch of the imagination. It's not as good as the first one. I just think, to your point, I think a lot of people probably just skipped it because they had already seen something that looked like this and that was unique for the first film. And a lot of time passed between the two. People probably just weren't geared up for it. Ray, what about you?
Well, I guess that kind of makes me the Sin City expert on the podcast. So this film became one of my favorite films almost immediately. I went to go see it in theaters. The style of it is the exact style of the comics. There's very few things that change from page to film. It's probably one of the best visual adaptations from source material. Even the actors look very similar to their comic counterparts. They did a good job with, you know, Mickey Rourke's facial prosthetics and Nick Stahl's facial prosthetics. But I do agree that, like, I wouldn't want to watch a ton of these movies. I'm both disappointed but not surprised that it didn't get a full franchise, even though there's, you know, I think 8 or 9 graphic novels out there, but you know, I totally get why they didn't do a ton of them.
And I suppose, I mean, it's 15 years old, but might as well throw the spoiler warning out there since we'll be talking about the film. Mm-hmm. But I think it's an interesting point because you're right. There's a ton of content that they could use, but you know, it's not the easiest movie to watch, I suppose, for a lot of people. I love it. I think it's incredible. It's one of my favorite movies. But I could understand why people wouldn't like it or wouldn't want to see a lot of it in this universe. You know, it's maybe similar to like Blade Runner, for example. I think Blade Runner is a gorgeous film, and 2049 even more so. But I understand why it doesn't become a blockbuster, you know, universe that people just clamor for. I get
the rewatch on Blade Runner is fairly difficult. It's not one that you can sit down and watch every night. Like it's something that sticks with you or it bores you. So it's just, I feel like Sin City has a similar effect. You know, I don't want to watch Sin City every day, but maybe I could go back to watching it once a year.
It has some heavy stuff in it, you know? I mean, even if the sexual themes don't bother you, there's a ton of violence and uncomfortable situations, and it's very gritty. And even though it has this comic booky layer on top of it that hides a lot of the gore, there's still a lot in there that's pretty gross at times and visceral even. And so, you know, it's not a feel-good movie by any stretch.
Right.
So Ryan, I'm curious. So since this was your first viewing, why have you not seen it prior to this? Was there any particular reason?
No, there was no particular reason. It's just one that kind of slipped under my radar. I mean, it came out right in the time when I was really getting into the movies like this, you know, and starting to really get heavy into the pop culture stuff. And I think, when did Watchmen come out? Was it around this time?
Year oh, before, boy. Year after?
Yeah, I mean, it was a similar era, I think.
I thought Watchmen was like 2007, 2008.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, no, 2009.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I
think 300 came out around this time.
Maybe that's what it was.
Both very stylistic.
Everybody in my family went and saw it, and I just never saw it. I don't know what was going on, but I got to be honest with you guys, I didn't really like it. So, okay. You know, I guess I'll be the voice of crapping on it or whatever. I guess maybe I'm too much of a simpleton to pick up on the bigger themes or whatever, but yeah, it just was not for me. It lost me right in the very beginning. I powered through it, and there were things I ended up liking about it, but overall, I wouldn't watch it again.
Well, I certainly don't want anyone to think that there's like a deep message here in
this
movie.
There absolutely is not. It's an ode to noir.
Yeah, I mean, it's gritty and sad to be gritty and sad, you know? I just think it's beautiful in the process. And I think that the cast really sells it for me personally. So I guess like maybe we'll start positive and go negative then. So Ryan, what were some of the things that you did like or you did enjoy?
I mean the.
Okay, what was your favorite little vignette? My
favorite vignette, probably Marv.
Yeah.
I was pretty impressed by the prosthetics work on him, and that's where a lot of my focus was. But. You know, the way they told the story I thought was interesting. You know, and I like big dumb characters sometimes. So, you know, he wasn't as dumb as they wanted, or as they portrayed him to be. Obviously, the things he was figuring out were not stupid.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that was probably my favorite of the stories.
Ray, what's your favorite?
Oh, boy. So Marv's story is called the Hard Goodbye, and I think my favorite was probably the one with Clive Owen and Rosario Dawson, which is called The Big Fat Kill.
It was tough for me to decide between the two of them, because that one, there was some great stuff in that one. I really liked the like city, or like, mm-hmm. I don't know if it was a full city of women or whatever, but the old town. Yeah. The women were really cool. And that was a neat, I would have liked to have seen more with like that whole side and leave out the guys.
Yeah.
But yeah,
I agree.
So I agree with you, Ray. That's my favorite one as well. And I do think it's more interesting, because I, you know, Marv is a cool character and I like him, you know, but most of that story is really just him either getting his ass kicked or kicking somebody's ass. There's not a whole lot else to it. And Hartigan's storyline, Bruce Willis's storyline, while there's some really cool things about it, particularly early on, it does get kind of weird at points in the end that are a little uncomfortable, and I'm not, you know.
I gotta agree. So this, I probably haven't watched this movie in like 5-6 years, and my life has changed. I went through kind of a hell of a situation, and I just don't watch this kind of stuff very often, and I don't think I'm gonna go back to it anytime soon. And I'm not saying there were like triggers in here for me, but there was a lot more about it that made me uncomfortable. I guess I just didn't see, or I just put a pass on it in 2005, but the amount of misogyny was so high up, and the amount of guys just hitting women so high up. I was kind of taken aback. To be fair,
there was a lot of women hitting guys too.
Yeah, like, there's
more
totally
nut shots per capita in this movie than like many other films all combined. But yes, you're right. There was a lot of misogyny in it, and that was something. This was my first viewing that really stood out to me. So
yeah.
Well, because even Marv, who's supposed to be the I don't hit women guy, still knocks Wendy out cold.
Yeah.
Now he thinks he's protecting her. That doesn't make it okay.
Right.
but even he does. Yeah. You know. I mean, I guess Hartigan doesn't.
Wendy, Gail, Nancy, and Brittany Murphy's character, they all get knocked around pretty intensely. So
yeah. There's a lot of that. What I was talking about with the Hartigan story, of course, is the relationship between him and Nancy and the fact that
very uncomfortable.
Yeah. I mean, you know, she's very much a child when they first meet. And they don't see each other again for 8 years. And, you know, the age gap is problematic on its own, let alone when you bring in the actual aspects of their relationship and why they know each other. It gets super strange. And, you know, I think it had been a while since I had seen it too. And I don't think I thought about it as much when I was younger, mainly because it's Jessica Alba and she's a few years older than me and I've always found her attractive, so I didn't think about it. But it's a weird plot thread for sure.
Yeah.
Going back
to it, I'm always more impressed about the small stuff in the background, the things that you spot later on. Like Nick Offerman is a bleach blonde thug named Schlub. And he was not famous at the time. He did very little stuff back in 2005, and you know, now he gets constant work. He's in movies and TV, and he is, so seeing him get knocked unconscious twice is kind of funny, you know, not because that's funny, but because it's just not what you expect. And you know, the credits are really interesting. Robert Rodriguez credited himself as cutting the movie. He credited Frank Miller as the main director and him as the side director. Special guest director was Tarantino, who did the tar pits with the dinosaurs and the Irish mercenaries. And he was the mercenary hanging upside down. You couldn't really tell because he was wearing a ton of makeup. Frank Miller was the priest that got his brains blown out at that really cool scene with Marv. I loved it when he just said, worth dying over, worth killing over, worth going to jail for. You know, that was great. The scene at the very beginning with Josh Hartnett and Marley Shelton was shot in Robert Rodriguez's house to prove to the studio that he could do this. It was shot in like 2 or 3 hours. And he selected them because they were just the closest in vicinity. So, you know, there's just fun stories behind it that you don't get from a lot of other movies. And Robert Rodriguez is such a weird director because he only does what he wants. I mean, it's crazy until you look at his body of work, where it's like Sin City, From Dusk Till Dawn, and you know, Shark Boy and Lava Girl.
Well, you know, he knows what he likes, and
sure.
I haven't seen Shark Boy and Lava Girl, so I can't really say how that went. But
didn't he do one of those movies with Quentin Tarantino, where like the Death Proof and whatever the other one was?
Yes, he did Planet Terror.
Planet Terror, that's right.
Tarantino did Death Proof.
Yeah, I knew Tarantino did Death Proof because that is unmistakably Tarantino. But yeah,
there's a lot of feet and a lot of dialogue.
It's actually, I think that's the only Tarantino movie I haven't seen that's left on my list.
What? Death Proof? Oh. Really? Man, we gotta review that.
I missed it. It was like kind of like with you in Sin City, I just missed it.
Yeah, so we're gonna do a whole Planet Terror Death Proof now.
I hope so, because yeah. I like those movies.
I'm adding it to the list.
Good.
So okay, so we talked about our favorite vignette. What about your least favorite? Which one did you like the least?
I mean, I love Bruce Willis. Hartigan is such a great and honorable character. And I feel like Bruce Willis is in his element in a noir over the top cheese setting. Yeah. But I hate everything else around it. I really do. I cannot stand stories about pedophiles. And even though Nick Stahl, of course, is a fantastic actor, that just is very unpleasant for me. And the idea that, you know, this 11-year-old girl would grow up to be in love with this. They say he's like 65, that he's like old enough to be her granddad. Yeah.
At most.
Yeah.
Well, because like the idea was he was supposed to be retiring, right, when it all goes down. And so even if he was 50 when he was retiring, he'd be at least 58 then by the time he gets out of prison. They just don't really age him up very much.
And no, that's very apparent when he is completely naked, hanging by his neck and swinging back and forth. And he's got this like wonderful ripped sculpted bod. And I'm like, no, 60-year-old looks like that.
I don't know. I'm sure there's some these days, but
it's like those old Bowflex commercials where it has like a super old guy head on like a 20-year-old body.
Right?
It looks
they
weird.
They totally just photoshopped that shit. It looks so creepy. Weird modern Frankenstein monsters.
Yeah, I mean, that would probably be, I think that's going to be all three of our least favorites for the reasons that we've already talked about for the most part.
Okay. I just wanted to check. I think you guys are right. I mean, I think Bruce Willis is really solid as that character, but that's really the only positive aspect to that story. Stahl's character, when he gets all changed, you know, in the future timeline, he's like yellow or whatever. And
that yellow bastard.
Yeah.
That's the name of this whole segment.
Right. I don't know. That always was, I felt like it was a little too much
what
for everything else.
What do you think he smells like? Because they keep, like, Hartigan keeps commenting on how the smell is just worse and worse. And, like garbage, like, feces. Like, what do you guys think it smells like?
I always kind of thought it was, like, a chemical plant kind of smell.
Ooh.
Right?
Gross. Like, smog and stuff? And chemical?
Like, chemical waste.
Ugh,
you know,
okay.
because it's supposed to be from all of like the medical experiments that they did on him to try and bring him back to being quote normal or whatever. And so I just imagine he's been pumped with crazy chemicals that are probably all illegal, and you know, his skin, like, to be that color, I don't even know what that would have to be. But that's kind of the only part of the movie that takes me out of the movie is the way he looks. It seems like it's just a little too fantastical for everything else that's going on.
Hmm.
Is that just me?
No. No. I was gonna say something. Hypothetically, if somebody shot your dicks off, would you go through all this? And like, is it worth it to have a dick again to look like that?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, I'm gonna say probably not.
They make fake ones, so
right? If John Bobbitt can get his life back, so can you.
Yeah, he became a porn star after that. I mean, there's hope for everyone.
So here's a story question, though, for a minute here. So when Hartigan does show up at the farm, Kevin's there, but Kevin doesn't interfere at all. Why do you think that is?
Because Kevin works for the other Rourke. He doesn't work for Senator Rourke. He works for a Cardinal Rourke.
But it's the same location, though. He's not going to, like, protect his property area.
The farm's pretty big. He has no interest in fighting with the brat, with that yellow bastard.
Okay.
So
that works for me. That works for an explanation for me.
Let's talk about Kevin, which has got to be Elijah Wood's creepiest character to date.
Man, yeah, like, I was so floored when I first saw him.
What a fun, like, acting out of type. You know, silent, fast, deadly, got crazy Lady Deathstrike nails.
And a Charlie Brown sweater.
Right?
It's such a weird character. It's certainly incredibly creepy. The idea that we never hear him talk, you know, is really very interesting. And I'm sure a hard sell for an actor. you know, to be like, hey, you want to be in this movie where they won't really see your face and you can't talk?
Well, that's very suspicious for a lot of actors, because once they find out they don't have any lines, they're like, oh, I'm getting cut.
Right, right. But it's a cool character. I think the visuals for it are great, like the glasses where they're mirrored over and everything like that. I just think he looks really cool. And when Marv is killing him, you know, leaving him to the wolf or the dog, and he just stares, the penetrating stare into the distance is like just really intense and very
it's cool. Unsettling.
Yeah, he does a great job.
I mean he's a fine character. I mean, he's a little weird for me, because they're showing how good he is at what he does, and you know, how quiet he is and how skilled of a fighter he is and everything else. And then like Marv can just beat him up because he decides he wants to. He grabbed him and that made all the difference. It's like, okay, I mean, I guess. Why did he leave the other girl alive after eating 10 other girls? Was it because he knew that Marv was gonna knew this girl and that they could escape together and that would set up the whole, you know what I mean? Like,
honestly, go ahead, Derek.
I was gonna say he leaves her alive because he doesn't kill them and then eat them. He eats them as he's killing them. Like, it's a process, right? And so like
they're good for weeks.
Well, yeah, I mean basically, because it's not it is like he is a cannibal and he is going to eat them, but there's more to it than that. And a lot of it is that power trip, right? I mean, that's another part of the Hartigan storyline too. It's all about the power trip. And so it's not as simple as I'm going to cut your head off and then eat you, right? It has to be much more than that. I have to make you watch, right? Like, that's the whole thing, is that he makes her watch him do it. It's all a process.
If he's so smart, does he fall for a jacket hanging on a stick in the middle of the woods?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
that's fair.
I mean, it was just, I don't know. There was like, the character was what they need him to be. That was one of my problems with this whole movie, was that nothing was consistent and everything was just whatever it needed to be at the time for the movie to make whatever little sense it made, in my opinion. And that starts right at the very beginning, and it bothered me the whole movie.
That was always my issue with Brittany Murphy's character, because she really wants Dwight to beat the shit out of Jackie Boy, but then she stops him when he goes after him. So Shelley's her name. That's it. You know, like, I get that she doesn't want him to die, but at the same time, her motives seem to be a little flip-floppy.
Yeah, I mean, I took that as her wanting to be protected from Del Toro's character, Jackie. But like you said, not actually have him killed, because at the end of the day, he is a cop and that would cause a lot of other issues. And she's not a bad person from anything we can tell, right? And so I think she just wants to be safe from him.
Yeah.
You know.
Any characters, you know, side characters that you did like, Ryan, that we haven't talked about?
I mean, Rosario Dawson's character was good. Most of the women in that storyline, like I said, that if they had pushed further into that, I feel like I would have enjoyed the movie a lot more. But that was most of the side characters that I liked or had any kind of caring for. Everybody else I found to be, you know, on a level of don't care too grating.
I like seeing Michael Clark Duncan, you know.
The cast was great.
I thought he was good. I thought he fulfilled the role well, right? He's basically the big enforcer guy, and that's, you know, because of his physical stature and his booming voice is something that he can pull off fairly well. Thought his eye was super creepy. But I liked his character as far as like side characters go.
Cool. What'd you guys think of Miho?
Miho was the sword wielding assassin from the women.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Again, the women characters in that last segment were some of my favorite characters, and I thought she was great.
Yeah, they're all really cool. I think they could have done, like Ryan kind of said at the beginning, an entire film on Old Town.
It's kind of like John Wick for me, where, you know, you have this whole underground assassin hotel thing, and that was like the coolest part of the movie. Mm-hmm. So I want to know more about that. And none of the movies really, well, so I guess they kind of started focusing on it more in the later John Wick movies. But this movie, the most interesting part to me was that whole like society that the cops leave alone and they, you know, do what they want, and it's all women. And, you know, that was the most interesting part to me. So
she's also like the only one that lives in Old Town who's not a prostitute. She's just there to be an enforcer.
Oh, Miho is?
Yeah. And that's not explained in the movie, but in the comic book it is. She's just a mute female assassin.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that whole thing could be a really cool film, right? Like, how did they get their kind of independence, and why, what led to that, I think would be really interesting. And you know, there could be some cool stories in there, because those characters definitely seem to be the most interesting, because the men are all, I think, very one note stereotypical characters, right?
Yeah.
You know, Marv is the big brood, and Hartigan is the old cop who's ready to retire, you know, and then, yeah, Stahl is the Rourke Jr. is the pedophile, and he's just a really terrible one. None of the guys really have much more to them. I mean, Dwight, I guess, Clive Owen's character, has the most, like, I guess, flexibility.
Well, he's the one with, like, the weird background you don't hear about. He keeps talking about how he's had facial reconstruction surgery to hide what he's done in the past, and he goes through it again in the second movie and in the comics, so it's like he has a cool backstory that we're not getting.
Yeah, and so that, like, that's what kind of piques his interest, and he has a really close tie with Rosario Dawson's character Gail, and so the whole Old Town thing, he knows the rules, he gets how it goes, so he could have even been part of a story that focused on that, which I think would have been interesting.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, I do kind of enjoy the conversations that Dwight has with Jackie after Jackie's dead in the car. I think are interesting, yeah. And there's some good Del Toro moments in there, because it's just kind of, you know, Dwight going crazy.
As unpleasant as Jack is, that scene is pretty cool, especially like he acts the hell out of it with his head back and forth and changing his voice. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it's really good. I really like that a lot. One other just small personal thing is I love the cars in this movie. I think they're all gorgeous. Kind of goes back to the cinematography I was talking about at the beginning, but yeah, I never really want a Thunderbird, a T-Bird, until I see these movies, and I'm like, oh yeah, right. Yeah, I'll take one.
See, I thought the same thing. I liked the cars in this movie, but I hated how these are the shitty cars in this world, apparently, because every one of them they refer to as like a rust bucket or a pile of junk or a bucket of bolts or whatever. It's like, these are clearly not that. So
they're all gorgeous.
I guess that part was consistent, that all the nice cars they call pieces of junk or whatever.
Yeah, the aesthetic in the movie is very strange, right? The whole aesthetic is certainly odd. And kind of like the power levels of things are a little odd. You know, like some of the guns will knock a guy back 20 feet, you know, for example, which isn't particularly realistic, but it kind of fits with the tone of the film. I don't know.
Does it? I mean, if we're going to get into that, then that's right away where it threw me off in the beginning and I started losing interest, is Bruce Willis shoots a couple of characters and they fly back, and then his gun turns into a cannon that, instead of knocking people 10 feet back, the same gun just blasts a hand completely off into smithereens. And then he gets shot by a gun that's incredibly similar and it does barely any damage to him, and he's just able to stand there, and he gets shot like 7 times and survives. And, you know, Marv can dive through the front of a car that's going 40 miles an hour and kill 2 cops and just come out with some scratches, you know. But then some other guys get punched in the face and die by him. And it's like there's no consistency to anything. And it makes it hard to care about any conflict in that universe when everything is as overpowered or underpowered as they, as anybody needs it to be. I think that that was very irritating to me throughout the whole movie. It was that way.
I always kind of wrote that off as an ode to the old movies where everything was conveniently there, like especially Bond movies, you know, he conveniently gets out of everything. And this same weapon is the like different all across the board. So I just kind of chalked it up to that. But yeah, going back, watching it now, like, yeah, I noticed that too. And I was a little more bothered than I was in 2005.
I'd yeah. be curious to hear how Derek thinks that that fits the tone of the movie.
No, I understand. Like the fact that it's inconsistent is the problem. Like if it had all just been overpowered ridiculousness throughout the whole film, I wouldn't have any problem with that because that would just be one of the gimmicks of the movie. But you're right. It's all over the place. And Hartigan getting shot so many times at essentially point blank range and then like being fine is a little silly. Now, yeah, the rich guy Rourke pays for all of the surgeries and yada yada yada, but the fact that he didn't bleed out before he made it to a hospital is just not realistic,
right? And that's something I didn't even mention, was he had a heart condition, he was basically getting ready to die, he was taking pills to keep him alive through this whole thing, and then he gets shot like 5 times and still manages to live, you know.
Yeah.
And what about the scene where Marv gets hit by this speeding car 3 times, thrown up into the air every time?
And well, Marv is consistent though, because he gets shot, he gets run over, he goes through a windshield, he gets electrocuted, and he still like pushes on. So it's consistent within his character that he's just like near.
But why?
I mean, it's just part of who he is. He's this big brute hulking guy. I mean,
but there's a lot of big brute hulking guys that they show, and none of them can take that much damage. Some of them get put down with one bullet, you know, to the body. So that, I don't know, it's clearly, if they were all shown to be superheroes that had a consistent set of powers, essentially, right? Like, he's the Hulk. He's near unkillable and super strong, then that's fine. But, you know, if you have another Hulk that's not unkillable, like you have Abomination and Hulk in the Incredible Hulk movie, right? They have same power sets, but then one is way more vulnerable than the other for no apparent reason. Then that doesn't make any sense to me.
I mean, that's fair. I'm not saying you're wrong or anything like that. Marv just didn't bother me. Hartigan bothered me, and some of the other ones did, but Marv's just didn't.
I was hoping that with Marv they were going to, because, you know, he's taking these pills to level out or to take care of his whatever psychosis or whatever diagnosed medical condition he has, mental health condition, and that he would be doing things that, like, a lot at the end, it was shown that he was doing, like, pretty shitty things, you know, that he just didn't know he was doing. He thought he was doing the right thing, and they didn't really play that angle up as much as I hoped they would.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things they could have done to try and be clever, right, and show that maybe some of this stuff was in his head and wasn't real, and he was fabricating that reality, but you're right, they don't go that route.
The problem is so much in the comics is explained as being like supernatural. Like in Miller's explanation, Miho and Kevin are actually, you know, demons. Miho's the good one, Kevin's the evil one. And Marv is kind of in between the two of them. He's this, you know, supernatural, can live through everything kind of guy, but that's not explained in the movie for any of them. So all of a sudden they can do all these things, and they have all these inconsistencies in their strength and I guess
their ability.
Thank you. So it just gets lost in the mix and kind of takes you out of it.
And then, you know, you get to the end, to Derek's point earlier about how that part took him out of the movie, you know, you get to the end and then this big yellow thing shows up and like smells bad and
yeah,
is a pedophile and whatever. Like, I don't know. I had a lot of trouble with that. It was just so weird. And like you were saying, inconsistent with the rest of the movie. It's just the consistency. And also Frank Miller is a much better graphic novel writer. That dialogue does not translate well. And from what I understand, the dialogue in this movie was very much like almost word for word out of the graphic novel. the narration and things like that, and it just does not translate well to live action, in my opinion. I mean,
did you guys ever see The Spirit?
I did not. I avoided that.
Gabriel Macht.
I did.
Okay, so Frank Miller, like 3 or 4 years after this, goes and directs a film on his own in the exact same style that this was. The only thing that was in color was The Spirit's red tie. And it's so bad. It is so bad. Like, and Frank Miller stopped directing. He was done. So he knows his place now, guys.
Thank God.
Right?
Also, something I haven't touched on. Derek, you liked this part of the movie. I did not. I think you mentioned it. Maybe it was Rachel. One of you guys said that you liked Bruce Willis kind of being this over, you know, I don't know. He was overacting everything. And,
yes.
And I get that that's supposed to be a character thing, but I didn't really buy it for any of the characters in this movie. And not any of the main characters anyway. And I know that's like a noir thing, but I would buy it in other noir movies. And this one, I did not really buy it. Because it didn't seem genuine, I guess, to me. I don't know. It seemed like Bruce Willis was trying to do an over-the-top noir performance, and it wasn't really landing. I don't know. It did not sit well with me. And it wasn't just him, but he was definitely the biggest culprit. And I like when Bruce Willis overacts. There's this one scene in The Fifth Element where he gets knocked in the back of the head with a trophy or something that's in his hotel or in his house, and he overacts that knockout so much, and it's my favorite part of that whole movie. But that was like him it wasn't him trying to overact. That was just how he thought the character would act. And in this one, it just like, so I like that usually, but in this he was trying to overact and it didn't work for me. I don't know.
Right.
That's fair. It's subjective. His character didn't bother me. But
his partner too, like
that, yeah, that Michael Madsen's character always bothers
just
me.
He was, when I was talking about grading earlier, his character was grating to me. There was nothing redeemable about the character. I did not like him at all.
Fair enough. I know that what you were talking about for Bruce Willis's character and stuff, that part didn't really get to me. I kind of just took it as them kind of poking fun at the noir genre a bit. You know, I mean, this movie doesn't have any big grandiose statements, but I do think it knows what it is and is kind of pushing that envelope of making fun of itself a little bit in a lot of these ways. You know, some of those lines that are being delivered, they know what they're saying, and they know that it might have been cool in a comic book, but there's just no way to deliver it and have it not sound cheesy.
Yeah.
I don't know. The whole movie just kind of came across as something that just was made just to be edgy, and maybe that's the way the graphic novel was too, but I mean, there wasn't much substance in it for me, and I don't need every movie to have substance. The visuals were the biggest redeeming quality for the movie for me, and made it so that I don't regret watching it or anything, but there just really wasn't any substance, in my opinion, in most of the movie.
Fair enough. Well, Ray, what else would you like to touch on in this one? Anything else?
No.
I feel like I crapped all over this, and you guys are just like, I ruined it. I ruined the podcast for you because I just...
No, not even a little. So, like, rewatching it was kind of eye-opening for me because I forgot that the F word's in it, and I absolutely hate that word so much now that, like, it totally took me out of it. Made me hate Becky's character even more. I still, like, even though it ends open-ended, like, the salesman and the client in the first one, obviously he's a hitman, and Marley Shelton obviously paid him to kill her. But in the last one, I always wonder, like, who paid him to kill Becky, and I never find out.
Is it not Gail?
I mean, I would imagine it's probably Gail. But still, like, she doesn't seem like she has any trouble killing. So figured she would just walk into her home and do it. But
well, I assume Becky like disappears right after that whole massacre in the alley, and Gail just wants to make sure she's dead.
Well, she goes to a hospital, and you know, the salesman finds her in the elevator. So, I mean, that's got to be right after that fight, you know? Like, she has a broken arm.
Well, it could have been a couple of days. I mean, maybe. I imagine she got far away, because that certainly doesn't look like, you know, she stayed around, you know?
No, it doesn't look like she stayed around. I just don't know how she would have escaped without somebody noticing, considering they were all perched on a ledge and she went and hid in a drain.
Maybe it went down to the sewers, or she stayed still until they left. I mean, I have no idea, right?
Yeah.
But I just assume Gale wanted her dead.
Yeah, that's fair. There are some nice boobs in this movie. Not enough dong.
There are a lot of attractive women in this movie.
Listen, you got that. A lot of dong in Watchmen. Which
no,
is
I didn't.
Similar
I got
stylized.
Dong that was edited later on, okay?
Well, I mean, one just dong. enjoy the memories.
You got at least like 10 boobs in this.
10?
I'm pretty sure like you at least get Jamie King's and Carla Gugino's, but that's, in the background,
I'm not a mathematician, but I'm pretty sure that's like four at most. I get that.
But in the background of Old Town and the strip club, Katie's, there's their boobs.
I didn't even notice, to be honest with you, that those particular scenes. So I counted four at maximum.
I never counted.
Of course you didn't.
But we can watch it again.
Rachel just said she doesn't really want to watch it again. So. Maybe if there was more dong, Rachel would be interested.
Yeah, I want even boobs to dong ratio.
Well, go watch Future Man, Rachel. It's on Hulu. There's a ton of dong in that movie. And some of it is really huge.
Is it Josh Hutcherson's? Like, does he go?
Kind of a spoiler. Oh! So I'm not going to say anything, but there
could be. Peter Mark's penis.
It's a weird, I could say yes and no, even though, never mind, you have to watch
it. That's hilarious.
I love that show, but there's so much dong in it.
Complicated shit here.
Yes.
Okay. So next week,
before we go on to this.
Okay.
What happened to Josh Hartnett, like, in real life?
He retired.
He quit acting for a while, and then he came back just for Penny Dreadful. He regrets not taking some roles. He was originally up to play Loki, which would have been a much different Loki. It would have been like this dark, brooding, quiet one.
It was just weird. It was kind of jarring seeing him in this movie, because the movie doesn't really feel dated, right. But seeing him feels dated. Because yeah. I don't see him anymore. So that was the only hint, if I didn't know, that this was from 2005 instead of, you know.
Well, you know, Michael Clark Duncan has been passed.
Well, that too, yeah. But I mean, but seeing him as, he hasn't acted in forever than anything I've seen, so. Mm-hmm.
That's fair.
Okay, now you can move on, Derek. Okay. I just wanted to address that.
So next week we are doing our 199th episode, and we are returning to bad movie reviews. Ray, do you want to tell us a bit about the movie you picked? League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Oh my God. Okay. So
I've never seen it. Any version of it.
Alan Moore wrote a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comic. It's about literary characters from the Victorian era all meeting up and solving worldwide issues, and it's a bad film. It did not translate well from the comics. It completely kind of threw out the comics. Personally, I'm just not a huge Alan Moore fan, and I know that is big comic blasphemy, but I'm just not. So I read the comics. I didn't really like it. There's a very intense and brutal rape scene in there. It still haunts me. And the movie is a poorly written yet fun popcorn film. Like, when you guys watch it, don't go into it thinking it's like you're gonna get a lot out of it. You're not.
I've seen it, but it's been since the movie came out. It's been a long time. So,
well, I wanted to pick it because this movie is so bad that Sean Connery quit acting afterwards. What is that even like?
He's been in some stinkers, so yes. that's saying a lot.
It absolutely has. Like, yeah.
Okie dokie.
It's widely considered one of the worst comic book adaptations ever made, and it's just not good, guys.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. All right. Well, anything else you guys want to discuss this week before we sign off?
I don't think so.
I'm good.
All right. Well, we, of course, are the Screen Heroes Podcast. You can find us at Screen Heroes Pod on Twitter or heroespodcasts.com. We also have a new Facebook group. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/groups/Screen Heroes. You can come and talk to us about movies and TV out there. We're also doing a big voting tournament for the MCU. We've had two matchups going on votes. We put a new matchup up every 48 hours or so. So come and join us in the group so you can vote. And like I said, we will be back next week to talk about the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And then it's our 200th episode, which is pretty exciting.
Woo!
Woo! Ray, where can people find you?
Siren Ray on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
But also mostly in her house. She doesn't leave very
Don't. Long. Well, no, not during quarantine.
Right, but don't visit her at her house.
Don't come to my house.
They don't want that.
Especially during quarantine.
Right?
Like, you should be in your house.
Even otherwise, no.
Ryan, how can people find you?
I prefer you didn't, but if you feel the need to, you can find my work at Buster Props on Facebook and Instagram. I don't really post anything lately.
I almost thought you were going to say your muggle job for a second there. I was like, no, don't do that.
No, I'm not doing that. And then also I'm in the Facebook Screen Heroes group where I like to argue with people and tell them how wrong they are about movies.
Oh, because they're so wrong.
Most of the time, yeah.
Right?
Fair Rachel's enough. In there too.
I
she'll
am.
Tell you you're wrong sometimes. Just don't argue with her much because then she'll stop. she knows how to stop. Some of us don't, but she does.
Like, I'm precious. I need a day off. So if I fight with you on Monday, you'll hear from me again on Thursday. I need recovery.
That's fair.
All right. Well, I am the Star Trek Dude on Twitter and Facebook. You can also find me on the Red Shirts and Runabouts podcast here on the Heroes Podcast Network. If Star Trek is your thing, we just wrapped up Star Trek Picard season 1. So you can go and check out that episode. We are Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network. Thank you for joining us. We will catch you next week. Don't forget to join us live Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Central, streaming in our Facebook group. Have a good week, everybody.
Woo!